Welcome, welcome from Alpha, to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 53rd episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Saturday, the 30th of August, 2014, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week's show brought to you by the very generous once-off donations of David M. and Olaf O. You too can contribute to the show's coffers by just clicking on that there donate button on the podcast website. This week, we have part two of our discussion with Professor Peter Hudis of Oakton Community College. We talk about the Soviet experiment and the alienation of labour, the role of the state in a post-capitalist society, the Spanish Revolution and the anarchist understanding of revolution, and the cooperative model as an alternative mode of production.
So like the Soviet system, it never really thought about the alienation of labour. It still seemed to be right there, bang in the middle.
Exactly. Now, you can say there was a perhaps understandable that this happened. Marx's writings in which he discusses alienated labor, many of those writings weren't available until the 1920s or 30s. His 1844 manuscripts with his famous essay, Alienated Labor, was not even published in anywhere in Russian until 1927 or something, and very few people got to read it. So people were brought up in a very truncated Marxism. They thought Marxism, they read the Communist Manifesto, few read Capital very carefully. The entire Second International and much of the Third International was really raised in this conception that the fundamental problem of capitalism is private property and the class of private property-owning capitalists and the existence of the free market that corresponds to both. You get rid of these three, you get rid of capitalism. The alienation doesn't really show up in the literature on Marxism at all until you get to Lukács in the early 20s, who, without even knowing the 1844 manuscripts, read Capital carefully enough, Marx's Capital, to see that that's what Marx was really talking about. But the Soviets shut down discussion of the theory of alienation. That was considered off limits, right? That was considered Hegelian idealism. This is why when Althusser started doing his work in the late 50s and 60s, he was really following a kind of Soviet diktat when he argued that, well, the theory of alienation was really not important for Marx. This comes from outside of Marxism. We don't really need this. But this is a time when he was a main theoretician of the French Communist Party. It fit with the ideology that he was propagating. They didn't want to talk about alienation, and they didn't talk about abolishing the dual character of labor at all. This was viewed by them in many cases as a trans-historical phenomena that existed in all societies. The only question is, how do you distribute the surplus? Does the capitalist get to distribute the surplus, or does the state get to distribute the surplus? That's really the model of those societies.
What would the role of the state be, according to Marx, in this post-capitalist system?
Good question. Now, with a lot of things, always have to keep in mind that Marx is not a closed book. In other words, his thought was constantly evolving. There was nobody who was less likely to view his own thought as a dogma than Marx himself. He was very critical, and not just critical, but self-critical, constantly revising. And on the question of the state, there's some very, very significant revisions and changes in his outlook on this question. If you read the Communist Manifesto, for instance, written early in his career, he says, well, what happens after the revolution? Well, the working class will seize state power and will use the state as an instrument, he says, to implement its control over society by expropriating the property of the bourgeoisie. It will seek to centralize the state power into its hands and use it as a revolutionary vehicle to break down and eliminate class divisions. And ultimately, he says, the state will wither away, okay, very famously. Now, that probably to this day is how most Marxists probably think of the state, as an instrument that is to be taken over and used on behalf of the oppressed classes. However, Marx changed his view of this. In 1871, he had witnessed the Paris Commune. And there was the first time there was actually a workers' revolution in his lifetime, a successful one, even though it only lasted 70 days, and only applied to one city. What did the workers in Paris do? Well, he writes the Civil War in France where he says, Actually, they didn't see state power and use it to centralize control over society. What happened in the Paris Commune is that the workers set up decentralized cooperatives and workers' councils, which governed production and distribution of goods and services in the city of Paris in this revolutionary period. Bakers' co-ops, farmers' co-ops, manufacturing co-ops, etc. They were coordinated through a kind of a elected body in which the members were subject to immediate recall, a coordinating committee. The power of the state was actually minimized. It was not that the workers took over the state and used it in their own interest to then consolidate social control. It's that they took over social relations and they used the power of the newly empowered social cooperatives and such to impose their will upon the state. So that Marx held that the state is not going to disappear automatically or quickly. This is disagreement with the anarchists. He said the state has existed since the origin of civilization. The state exists so long as there is class divisions of society. And the state is going to exist for a long time following the revolution because it's been with us for a long time, right? It doesn't think it's you snap your fingers or you just hope it, wish it out of existence and it goes away. But he says in 1871, the Paris Communards, instead of having the state be the dominant force over society governing it, instead the society imposed its will upon the state and made the state a servant to its freely associated social relations. So there's an inversion here. Instead of the state being on top controlling society, it's the society, what we now call civil institutions of civil society, taking over and imposing their will upon the state apparatus and thereby minimizing the power and control of that state apparatus. Now, that's where he ends at the end of his life. He says that is what he means by the dictatorship of the proletariat. He never meant the dictatorship of the proletariat as a party dictating to the proletariat through the state. It was a non-state form, the Paris Commune, he writes, a non-state form that created the lever for creating the transition to a socialist society. That's his mature view of it.
So this is quite similar to how things were operating, say, in the Spanish Revolution.
Absolutely. I think in some respects, the Spanish Revolution is a more important instantiation of a revolution, has more lessons for it than the 1917 Russian Revolution. Because in Russia, they had the model of first see state power, then figure out what you're going to do, right? And of course, there was some degree of efforts in the years following the Russian Revolution to try to move to some sort of workers' control of production, but it was rather limited, and it was, of course, subverted in part, large part, by the Bolsheviks themselves, because they didn't want it to compete with the political power of the party, which was controlling the state. Spain was the reverse. Spain, they didn't concern themselves so much with seizing the state power and then implementing the social transformation. The workers and peasants seized control of the estates and the factories as the prelude to the social transformation, you see? The sit-downs, right? Occupations. This is a much more conducive approach, because it gets closer to the root of the problem. The state is not the root of the problem. So statist socialists and traditional anarchists tend to be opposite sides of the same coin on this, but they're both not looking at the right issue. The real issue is the social relations at the point of production and the human relations in society as a whole. You create freely associated institutions there that drives the revolution. Then the state becomes a secondary factor. Now, it's not to say the state is not going to be there at all. I'm not saying you can ignore the state. It's going to be with us for some time after a revolution. But the question is, which approach do you take vis-a-vis the state? This is where I think Marx has a lot to teach us.
I am well aware that it is now the fashion to deny socialism has anything to do with equality. In every country in the world, a huge tribe of party hacks and sleek little professors are busy proving that socialism means no more than a planned state capitalism with the grab motive left intact. But fortunately, there also exists a vision of socialism quite different from this. The thing that attracts ordinary men to socialism and makes them willing to risk their skins for it, the mystique of socialism, is the idea of equality. To the vast majority of people, socialism means a classless society, or it means nothing at all. And it was here that those few months in the militia were valuable to me. For the Spanish militias, while they lasted, were a sort of microcosm of a classless society. In that community where no one was on the make, where there was a shortage of everything but no privilege and no bootlicking, one got perhaps a crude forecast of what the opening stages of socialism might be like. And after all, instead of disillusioning me, it deeply attracted me. The effect was to make my desire to see socialism established much more actual than it had been before.
What do you understand as the traditional anarchist understanding of, say, that process?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. It would be also hard to even answering if you ask what's a traditional Marxist understanding. In a sense, even more difficult question to answer with the anarchists, because anarchism has been a very varied movement. I have to say that one thing I find unfortunate is that there's been so much antagonism between Marxists and anarchists, because the anarchists, at least some segments of the anarchist movement, were quite brilliant in anticipating some of the problems that can come from a state-directed or state-controlled revolution. And the Marxists could have learned from that. The anarchist also could have learned from the Marxists the critique of political economy and the need to transform and eliminate the whole foundation of value production. You don't get much of a rigorous or serious critique of political economy within the anarchist tradition. I think its main shortcoming. But I think there's been elements of the anarchist tradition. When I say elements, I don't mean the Bakuninist wing, which tended to be very conspiratorial and even secretive and in some cases authoritarian in its own right, nor the individualistic anarchist tradition of Stirner, which I don't think is very important. But certainly there's many traditions of anarchism, especially anarcho-syndicalists, that understood the need for a grassroots, freely associated approach to social transformation, and who were rightfully opposed to the notion of a single-party state. I think one of the worst things that happened to Marxism was this incorporation of the notion of a single party to lead that would then assume state power and rule on behalf of the masses. This was not, by the way, in Marx himself. Marx himself never advocated a single party to lead a revolution, let alone a single party to govern a post-capitalist society. You won't find any mention of that in his writings. And this is one reason why Marx was able to work with many anarchists through his life. I mean, he was good friends with Bakunin for many years till they had a falling out. He was even friends with Proudhon before they had a falling out. In the First International, the anarchists and the Marxists worked together for a period of time. In the Paris Commune, that's even more true. So perhaps on some level, there's been too much made of the difference between these two traditions, although, again, I'm simplifying here because it really depends on which Marxist one is talking about or which anarchist one is talking about. But just on a personal note, I don't know if this will help any, but very often some of my friends from the Marxist tradition say, you're too anarchist to be a Marxist. And some of the anarchist friends of mine say, you're too Marxist to be an anarchist. So I myself find myself straddling in some respects the two traditions on some questions.
What does our analysis of the Spanish Revolution, what does that have to say about the success of this revolutionary approach that we're putting forward?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the model in this, if we were to call it that, the approach that was taken in the Spanish Revolution, of course, kind of receded, right? It was subsumed throughout the world by what seemed to be, to many, the much more successful model of the Russian Revolutionary approach, the approach taken in the Russian Revolution. That's the model that was taken up in the developed world, in China, right? That was the approach taken up by the communist movement. And frankly, that was the approach taken up by the Western socialist movement, which also was top down, and although not arguing for a revolutionary seizure of power, but talking for a reformist transformation through existing parliamentary institutions. Both of them really proceeded in a direction that was actually rather distant from what happened in Spain. Spain was this shining exception in a certain sense that then got buried to a large degree by this incredible predominance of Stalinism. And of course, the World War II and the fight between Stalinism and fascism made it even more seen that, well, which alternative are you going to pick? Western imperialism, the Soviet Union, or, you know, existing or fascism? Well, a lot of people didn't have trouble making up their mind where they were going to side on that one. They picked the Soviet model. But the interesting thing to me is since 89, and again, I think this was already starting to happen before then, with the collapse of this so-called Soviet model, which, by the way, had nothing to do with the original Soviets, which were decentralized workers' councils, much like the Paris Commune, we see this different spirit flowing. And I think you see it in the Arab Spring. You see it in the Occupy movement. You see it in the protest in Sarajevo this year. You see it in Gezi Park in Turkey. You see all these social movements that are very, very clear when they emerge that we need decentralized, non-hierarchical forms of organization in which we occupy public space and try to arrange non-alienated human relations within the very course of the struggle. I mean, this is extraordinarily encouraging to me to see these kinds of developments, even in places where the subsequent outcome, as in the Arab revolutions, has deteriorated in a direction that's not very helpful. But it's not over yet. I mean, we don't know exactly where all this is going to be ending up going. But I think that there's a different wind blowing now. There's kind of an incubus of the old model that's been lifted off of our mind. And now I think I don't see any evidence that people really want anywhere in the world a return to the old hierarchical model that created the state capital societies that called themselves socialist or communist.
In the Russian Revolution, they had a revolution in 1905 originally. So what is happening in Egypt, say, for example, these processes can be over many decades.
Exactly. And one reason I do a lot of work on Rosa Luxemburg, I'm helping to edit her complete works, 14 volumes in English, this project that I'm involved in, is because she speaks so directly to this. She was involved in the 1905 Russian Revolution. She actually was a direct participant as well as a theorist of it. And she captured, she understood, she saw that there was this spontaneous self-mobilization from below that was not coming from the trade unions, was not coming from the established political parties. The Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks did not see this 1905 revolution coming. She saw that there was this great ferment from below. And this is what she said radicals had to learn from throughout the rest of Europe and reorganize themselves on the basis of. Yes, it then was crushed within a few years, but then it resurfaced again, this decentralized council form of organization of the Soviets in 1917. Again, not created by the Bolsheviks or the other tendencies. It was created by mass, you know, organizations, by spontaneous groups of individuals themselves. And then, of course, by 1917, all the political parties jumped into them to try to see if they could influence them. And that's a whole nother story. So, yes, we don't know what's next on the horizon. And I think in the case of Egypt, Sisi may look, who's running Egypt now, may look very powerful. But look, I think it's his lack of power that establishes why he's cracking down so hard and sentencing 1,000 people at a time to the death penalty, right? It's precisely because there was so much hope generated in Egypt for a democratic, pluralistic model of development that then ran into this bad situation. The military took over, but it's a very unstable rule that the military has over this situation. This is not like Napoleon Bonaparte taking over in France in 1851 and then imposing 20 years of secure capitalistic development upon the country. I don't see that happening in Egypt. I see a very fragile, insecure military running Egypt that's terrified of what's going to be popping up next, which indicates that it's not dead yet and it may resurface in some other form.
On the 14th of August, hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood supporters were massacred at the Rabat al-Adawiyah Mosque in Cairo. The crackdown on the Islamist protest camp was so dangerous, there was no way journalists could get anywhere close to what was going on until it was over and the bodies were already laid out in rows. But one person in the crowd being targeted had the unbelievable presence of mind to film everything that was happening. He's uploaded 9 minutes of absolutely terrifying video to YouTube. What he shows is supporters of the ousted president Mohamed Morsi throwing rocks at the army, who respond with gunfire. He manages to document the injuries sustained by protesters and keep filming while people around him are bleeding and dying. International journalists have been killed in Egypt recently, and Egypt's own media and press have been accused of glossing over the massacre, even praising the generals behind it. And that's why this footage is so important. It shows the other side to the story. Without it, we would only have the army's statements and films to go on. And at the time, the army was saying that they used the minimum amount of force necessary to clear the area.
There's been a lot of discussion, for instance, is a lot of discussion the last 20 years, and it's part of this whole kind of new social movements phenomenon that's connected to this, is a cooperative movement. There's a lot of discussion about this now. Yeah, I think that workers, there is a very great interest once again in, you know, forms of cooperatives, the Argentina from 2001, what's been so-called horizontalism, other examples of this in Latin America and elsewhere. There's a great interest in cooperatives and discussing them as an alternative model of social development. And I'm very much sympathetic to this approach insofar as, look, these can be ways that we can figure out exactly how to work out non-alienated forms of production. How can we work out forms of freely associated production that does not compromise on efficiency or damage the environment? These are wonderful laboratories of social experimentation. So I don't think we should be too dismissive of them. But we also have to keep in mind that socially necessary labor time is very much the law that dominates the entire globe at the moment. So if you're a cooperative and you're producing a given good, okay, and somewhere else there's a traditional capitalistic enterprise that's producing the same good, and now they're in competition for purchases of those goods, right? What's going to happen when that capitalistic enterprise creates greater efficiencies, okay, and can produce that good cheaper? And it could be produced cheaper because it's less environmentally friendly. It could be produced more cheaply because the workers are exploited more. What then does the cooperative do, right? It runs into this problem because it could be undersold by its capitalistic competitor. This is a big problem because there's a difference between formal control of production and actual effective control of production. Cooperatives give you at the very least, formal control of production. The cooperatives control their work process, they control what they produce, how they produce, when they produce, the manner in which they produce, etc. All that is very good. But formal control may not translate into effective control if you're still surrounded by a capitalistic market economy, if you're still surrounded by the capitalist law of value, if you're still subjected to the domination of socially necessary labor time on a global level. Because then what you're going to be confronting, right, is this pressure to conform to the social average. Now, you can then come back to your cooperative and democratically vote, hey, we're going to exploit ourselves a little bit, or we're going to damage the environment some more in order to meet the social average of efficiency that's established by, you know, the world market that's existing outside of us in order to maintain our existence. You can do that. Marx called this workers valorizing their own labor power. In other words, workers become their own capitalists in this kind of situation. And you no longer really have control over your cooperative because something else from outside is forcing these decisions upon you behind your back all over again. So that's the problem of having cooperatives as small islands surrounded by a capitalistic sea. You'd have to have a much more systemic social transformation for that to work.
Could we see them as a cultural incubator for people, say if the economy in some strange future, maybe 20 years down the road, say 20 or 30% of it was worker-owned in cooperatives? Like, could we see this as the seed for what needs to happen to encourage a revolutionary change away from value production?
Yes, that's possible if. And why I put the conditional if in is if, and only if, that cooperative production truly embodies a serious challenge to the system of value production. It's always going to depend on how much compromises is made in that system of cooperative with the pressures being generated upon it from the outside. So, for instance, to give you an example, the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain, which have been worker-owned cooperatives, been in existence for some 60 years now. They employ over 100,000 people. Certainly, there's a lot we can learn from them about alternative forms of organizing our economic and social existence. But some studies that have come out have acknowledged that alienated conditions of labor are more and more dominating in many of these cooperatives. So does that make it a model? Well, then we'd have to have a critical analysis, because it's not so pure as it may appear at first sight. It's being adulterated by various other elements from the surrounding society that are percolating into it. So you really have to look at everything with a critical eye and can't be overly enthusiastic about anything. One of my favorite quotes from Marx is that a dialectician doesn't allow himself to get too impressed with anything, the dialectic being by its very nature critical and revolutionary. But that doesn't mean you dismiss it and just say, oh, well, we know that's not going to work out. Because that's the other thing you want to avoid, that all too knowing look that says, oh, we know it's all going to fail because blah, blah, blah. We don't know that. You have to be open, and at the same time, you have to be critical-minded and explore whatever contradictions are there.
Well, Peter, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Sweet dream, baby.
On this episode, we heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, Sun Ra and his orchestra, and George Orwell on socialism from his classic Homage to Catalonia, accompanied by Daft Punk's Around the World. You also heard the YouTube star Truthloader reporting on the massacre at the Rabah Al-Adiwa Mosque in Cairo, to the tune of Quien Quien Be Adi Mao, by K. Fringpong and his Cubano Fiesta, and you are now listening to Roy Orbison with Dream Baby. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega.